What if everything you know about debt, money, and markets is wrong? Imagine discovering that the economic principles taught in every textbook are built on myths that have shaped civilization for 5,000 years. This is the radical premise of debt, which challenges our most fundamental assumptions about financial obligations. The seemingly innocent moral principle that one must pay one's debts has justified terrible injustices throughout history while concealing complex power dynamics. By examining debt's evolution across civilizations, we discover how this concept has been weaponized by the powerful and how our modern financial system rests on historical fiction rather than economic necessity. Every economics textbook claims money evolved from barter's inefficiencies, yet anthropologists have never found a society primarily using barter for everyday transactions. Instead, small communities operate on informal credit systems. When Henry needs shoes, Joshua makes them with the understanding Henry will reciprocate later. These arrangements prioritize relationships over exact accounting. Barter does exist, but between strangers or potential enemies, often with elaborate rituals managing tension. The Gunwingu of Australia practice ceremonial exchange involving music, dancing, and ritualized sexual encounters, far from economists' imagined straightforward transactions. Historical evidence shows credit preceded cash. Mesopotamian tablets reveal accounting systems thousands of years before physical currency. Money's primary function wasn't facilitating exchanges between neighbors, who used informal credit, but enabling transactions with strangers and paying taxes to emerging states. This myth persists despite evidence because it's fundamental to economics as a discipline, allowing us to view markets as natural phenomena rather than social constructs reflecting power relationships. Money originated not from barter, but organized violence. Coins first appeared alongside professional armies needing standardized payment. This military coinage slavery complex depended on enslaved war captives mining precious metals, with Alexander's army alone requiring half a ton of silver daily. Rulers issued coins and demanded them back as taxes, creating markets as a consequence. When soldiers received coins and citizens needed them for taxes, economies essentially became machines for provisioning armies. Colonial powers employed similar tactics. In Madagascar, the French imposed taxes payable only in francs, forcing farmers to sell crops at harvest when prices were lowest, creating debt cycles. This reveals money's true nature, not a naturally evolved commodity, but a social technology imposed through power. Money represents quantified, transferable debt obligation between strangers, with its authority stemming from state acceptance for tax payments. The connection between violence and money crystallized during the Axial Age, 800 to 600 BCE, when coinage emerged across Greece, India, and China, alongside major philosophical traditions, reactions seeking ethical foundations beyond the materialistic market worldview. This reveals money's true nature, not a naturally evolved commodity, but a social technology imposed through power. Money represents quantified, transferable debt obligation between strangers, with its authority stemming from state acceptance for tax payments. The connection between violence and money crystallized during the Axial Age, 800 to 600 BCE, when coinage emerged across Greece, India, and China alongside major philosophical traditions. Reactions seeking ethical foundations beyond the materialistic market worldview. When imperial violence receded throughout history, societies reverted to credit systems rather than coin. Medieval Islamic commerce developed sophisticated financial instruments operating independently of state control. By 1000 CE in Basra, banking became essential to commerce, with traders conducting transactions by check. These instruments were advanced. Checks could be transferred, while letters of credit enabled long-distance trade. Unlike state currency, these systems operated on trust and reputation. Having a poet mock you for bouncing a check devastated one's commercial standing. Islamic courts provided voluntary mediation, but the system fundamentally relied on honor. Instead of interest-bearing loans, Islamic finance created partnerships where investors supplied capital and entrepreneurs provided labor, sharing profits between them. Remarkably, reputation itself became recognized as capital. Merchants could form partnerships of the penniless based solely on their good names. Medieval Chinese Buddhism developed similar systems. Monasteries functioned as financial institutions, offering low-interest loans while developing sophisticated investments. These religious institutions became the world's first corporations, seeking profitable ventures while operating under moral principles. These examples reveal alternatives to modern finance, economic systems based on trust and mutual aid rather than state violence. All human societies operate on three fundamental economic principles. First, baseline communism. Sharing according to ability and need forms the foundation of sociability. We expect strangers to give directions or hold elevator doors without calculation, a principle most visible during disasters when hierarchies temporarily dissolve. Second, exchange, the back-and-forth process where each side gives equivalently. Unlike communism's mutuality, exchange seeks balance. Paradoxically, while each party may try to outdo the other, interactions typically conclude when both consider the outcome fair. Third, hierarchy, relationships not based on reciprocity but precedent. When we consistently give gifts to someone who never reciprocates, like a king, we're acknowledging superior status rather than engaging in exchange. We constantly shift between these frameworks, practicing communism with close friends, maintaining careful accounting with acquaintances, and acting as authorities with children. These aren't different society types, but moral principles coexisting everywhere. The puzzle is why we persistently reframe everything as reciprocity, and debt marketplace language has permeated human life so thoroughly that we struggle to imagine alternatives beyond debts that must be paid. The process that dislodges people from webs of mutual commitment to make them exchangeable has shaped our basic assumptions through the logic of debt. Slavery represents the logical endpoint of this disentanglement, its legacy embedded in our concepts of property and freedom. The Atlantic slave trade operated through a complex credit system with devastating consequences. In West African ports, European traders advanced manufactured goods on credit to African merchants to be repaid in slaves. They demanded human collateral from the merchants' own families to secure these debts. Upriver, existing social institutions transformed into mechanisms of enslavement. Systems originally acknowledging unpayable debts, like compensation for accidental death, became perverted. Debtors turned into collectors, seizing others' children to satisfy creditors. Many eventually pawned their own children and themselves, ending up on transatlantic slave ships. This reveals debt's darkest potential, its ability to transform human relationships into property relationships. When moral obligations become mere mathematical calculations, humans become things. The histories of debt and slavery remain intertwined, shaping our world in ways rarely acknowledged. We need a biblical-style jubilee for international and consumer debt to ease suffering and remind us that money isn't sacred, debt repayment isn't moral essence, and democracy allows different arrangements. Historically, imperial states have resisted this approach, eliminating extreme abuses like debt slavery and using imperial wealth to benefit poorer citizens while never challenging debt itself. The United States follows this pattern by removing debtors' prisons and providing subsidies while maintaining debt repayment as sacred. This principle is clearly a lie. Only some must pay their debts. Banks receive bailouts while homeowners face foreclosure. Corporations declare bankruptcy while student loan borrowers remain trapped even in bankruptcy. Debt corrupts promises through math and violence. If freedom means making friends, it also means making genuine promises. We can't predict what truly free people might promise each other without first creating conditions for discovery. Perhaps we should value those who choose relationships over endless production. They may pioneer a new economic order without our system's self-destructive tendencies. The first step is accepting that no one can dictate our true value or what we truly owe.